Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story. Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 27th of February, these are our main stories. The leader of one of Europe's most feared drug gangs has been jailed for life. The US President Joe Biden says progress is being made over agreeing a ceasefire in Gaza, and thousands are taking to the streets in Nigeria over the spiralling cost of living. Also in this podcast, what would another term for Donald Trump mean for the rest of the world? And the mighty sound made by a minute fish. We're going to start this podcast at a heavily guarded courthouse near Amsterdam, ringed by masked police, armed with automatic weapons and drones hovering overhead. Security was very tight because inside and on trial were members of a huge drug trafficking network who used murders to get their business done. A few hours before we came to record this podcast, the judge, not identified for security reasons, said, "We're sentencing all the suspects."
We impose the following prison sentences. Ridwan Taghi gets life in prison. Said Razouki gets life in prison. Mario R. gets life in prison.
Our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan, told me more about the people sentenced today.
The undisputed, they say, leader of this criminal organisation. Let me tell you about him. His name is Ridwan Taghi. For a long time, he was the Netherlands' most wanted man. He was arrested in Dubai in 2019. He has been found guilty of a series of liquidations, as gangland murders here in the Netherlands are often referred to. Five liquidations, a series of attempted murders. In fact, five people, the court says, were murdered over a period of just 1.5 years. A number of other attempted murders, an attack on a spy shop that was supplying this gang with equipment. He wasn't actually in court today. 8 of the 17 gang members were. And among those who received sentences, the key prosecution witness, a man named Nabil B, was given a reduced sentence of 10 years because it was primarily his testimony. He was involved in some of these attacks that helped the prosecution arrive at these charges, and ultimately the judge deliver these sentences today.
Anna, to what extent is this being seen as a key moment in the fight against illicit drug gangs?
I think this has made the Netherlands confront a very dark underworld that is increasingly seeping through into mainstream society. And just before the hearing began, the judge talked about three other assassinations that you may have heard of. The killing of the key prosecution witness's lawyer, an investigative journalist, Peter R. de Vries, who was acting as a confidant for the key prosecution witness. And another assassination. Those weren't dealt with as part of this trial. They're being handled in separate proceedings. But drugs are a huge problem here, and it's partly the relaxed policy on soft drugs that attracts these kinds of criminal networks. So Ridwan Taghi has been found guilty of leading what prosecutors said was one of the biggest and most influential drug smuggling networks in Europe.
Anna Holligan. Since the conflict in Gaza began in October, there has been just one brief let-up in the fighting. For 7 days at the end of November, there was a ceasefire, but since then, the bombardments have continued day and night. For weeks, talks in Paris and Qatar have tried to lay the foundations for a new halt to the violence. Now, the US President Joe Biden says they could be about to bear fruit.
Well, I hope by the beginning of the weekend. The end of the weekend. My national security advisor tells me that we're close. We're close. It's not done yet. And my hope is by next Monday, we'll have a ceasefire.
Shortly after that comment, President Biden also appeared on the television network NBC, where he said Israel had agreed in principle to pause its attacks in the Gaza Strip during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which starts on March the 10th. Scott Anderson is the UN aid agency UNRWA's deputy director of affairs in Gaza. He's in Rafah.
It's very much a pressure cooker. People are very desperate for any good news. And a ceasefire would go a long way to giving people some relief because people are scared. Over 100,000 people have been impacted by this conflict. Nearly 30,000 have died in Gaza. Over 70,000 have been injured. There's very few families that you can find that have not been impacted in some way, either through death or injury. And as I said, there's also just a grain of hope that there will be a ceasefire and people can begin to rebuild their lives.
Hope, too, for the remaining 130 Israeli hostages and their families still held by Hamas. Shai Wenkert's son, Omar, is one of those hostages. He was abducted to Gaza on October the 7th from the Supernova Desert Festival.
I heard from Omar 90 days ago. We had an evidence from the released hostages, but it was 90 days ago, and since then we don't have any information about him. There is now negotiation, and we are full of faith that something is going through this negotiation. Omar is a colitis disease. It's a chronic disease of the stomach. I believe he needs to get out, to get his medicine, to get his health care, to get a medical aid, because we know he don't get anything over there.
I got more details about the terms of a possible ceasefire from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell.
From what we understand, the framework deal that was talked about in these talks in Paris recently with the Israelis involved, also the Qataris and Egyptians who've been serving as mediators and with US involvement as well. This, according to the Reuters news agency, produced a sort of draft proposal that includes a 40-day pause in all military operations, the exchange of Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages at a ratio of 10 to 1. And Reuters is quoting a senior source close to the talks. This proposed ceasefire also involves allowing hospitals and bakeries in Gaza to be repaired and a big increase in the amount of aid going into Gaza, something like 500 aid lorries entering each day. But although we've had these very positive comments from President Biden after he appeared on a late night show in New York, we have been hearing from both the Israeli media quoting unnamed Israeli officials, and also the BBC's been hearing from Hamas officials who are much less positive about how close we are to a new deal.
Yeah, we've heard lots of near misses over the last few weeks in terms of whether or not a ceasefire will start. And we're also hearing that Prime Minister Netanyahu is still saying that any ceasefire, if and when it comes, will only be temporary, and that offensive on Rafah will go ahead.
Indeed, and this is really linked to the key sticking point, because you have Israel's insistence that any temporary truce deal will not guarantee an end to the war. And that is really precisely what Hamas is demanding. What it says is an end to Israel's aggression on Gaza and a complete withdrawal of Israeli troops. Now, Israel has vowed not to halt its efforts until it has dismantled Hamas. It said it will destroy the group consistently since those shocking 7th of October attacks by Hamas fighters on the south of Israel. So this is really where we have the kind of the crux of the issue. And there was also a Hamas official speaking to one of our BBC staff members who told him that the priority was not to exchange hostages, but to stop this war.
Yolan Nell in Jerusalem. Now, what would a second Donald Trump presidential term mean for the rest of the world? Now that he's all but certain to win the Republican nomination, there's been intense focus on some of the former president's latest foreign policy comments, in particular his suggestion that he'd let Russia attack NATO countries that don't meet the alliance's spending guidelines. From Washington, our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman went to find out at CPAC, that's the annual gathering of conservative activists.
I've got exposed fraud flashing here. What's that about?
That's a bonus mode.
Once upon a time, this event took in conservatives of all stripes. Now that's changed.
We will make America great again.
These days, the pinball game being showcased by a delegate is called January 6th Insurrection. CPAC is dominated by followers of Donald Trump.
It's the Biden administration that wants to spend an unlimited amount of money in Ukraine.
Do you think the U.S. should stay in NATO?
No. I think we should abolish all the cool kids clubs.
The counter-argument is that if the U.S. isn't there for Ukraine, Putin will march in and the rest of Europe is at risk. Isn't that a concern?
No, it's really not. My concern is America.
This is the base helping drive Mr. Trump's pronouncements about home and abroad. And sparking a fresh wave of concern in Europe, his comments on NATO.
One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia. Will you protect us? I said, no, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay.
This, say his opponents, is destabilizing rhetoric, a signal to Russia that the U.S. under Trump could abandon European security.
Make diplomacy great again.
Backstage, I meet Katie McFarland, Mr. Trump's deputy national security advisor during his first year in power. She sees Trump's words as bravado, an attention-grabbing tactic to further boost defence spending in Europe, but not to abandon NATO. But how about what some see as his embrace of Putin, with US weapons transfers to Ukraine now stalled for months by his Republican allies in Congress?
Trump has said that he'll solve the Ukraine war in one day. I think it's probably a week. I don't think he'll do it in one day, but here's how he would do it. He said, I'll go to Putin and I'll say, you go to the negotiating table or I'm going to give Ukraine offensive weapons. Go to the Zelensky and say, you go to the negotiating table or I'm not going to give you any weapons.
I mean, all Ukrainians and many Europeans would see that as effectively a Ukrainian surrender because it's...
What's the alternative?
Well,
stalemate
because
war for 20 years?
But they would see the invasion as unjustified.
I don't want to reward Putin for his behavior. But on the other hand, let's be practical about this. It's a war of attrition. Who wins a war of attrition? You tell me. The bigger country, the richer country.
Away from the convention, I spoke to Oana Langescu, now with the defense think tank RUSI. She ran the NATO communications team for nearly a decade and a half and was there during the entire Trump term.
Donald Trump is an unpredictable politician. In all the meetings that I was in, you were never quite sure how long they would take. It was always about keeping people on edge.
She says this did help push NATO countries to spend more on defense, but this was part of a trend that actually began well before his presidency and spiked later due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. She warns that even Mr. Trump's talk of leaving some NATO countries undefended is fraught with danger.
Any discussion about a two-tiered alliance where only some allies, those who invest 2% on defense, would get security guarantees while others would not, is deeply destabilizing and can undermine NATO deterrence for all allies, not just for some.
So would a second term of America First leave Europe at more risk of attack by Russia? The facts on the ground in Ukraine will matter. But, says Natalie Tocci of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome, Mr. Trump only accelerates a trend in which the US's peer rival China will dominate its security thinking.
Trump sort of catalyzes this moment and draws attention to a deeper problem. In a world of multiple powers in which the US will not have the hegemonic role that it had in the past, it will be less and less committed to European security. I think that is a trend that has been going on basically since 2008, so since Obama. We're accelerating towards a wall, and despite everything that's happening, we're still not really stepping up to the plate in terms of action.
The US has been retrenching from Europe more or less since the end of the Cold War. Donald Trump's foreign policy proposals, insofar as they are clear, only add boosters, unpredictability, to a strategic trend. The US served as Europe's security umbrella for most of the 20th century. The long-term promise of that cover has been wearing thinner as the showers of war come closer.
Tom Bateman. Now to an extraordinary discovery. That rather ominous sound comes from one of the world's smallest fish, just a centimetre long. The translucent Damionella cerebrum lives in mountain streams in Myanmar. We've actually had to reduce the volume quite a bit because scientists say it comes in at 140 decibels, loud enough to cause human pain or even hearing loss. So how does something so small make so much noise? A question for our environment correspondent, Matt McGraw.
Indeed, it does make an awful lot of noise, Nick. It's one of those, I suppose, evolutionary accidents of history. The researchers in Berlin, they use this tiny fish. It's transparent. They use it in their experiments so they can see its brain, its organs. They hadn't really noticed the noise, to be honest with you. When they did, they set about investigating it, and they found that this tiny 12-millimetre fish was pumping out 140 decibels, as you say, the equivalent of a gunshot. And it does this using its muscles to beat on its own swim bladder. That's an organ within it that keeps it afloat. And according to Verity Cook, the lead author on this piece of research, it's all about evolution and it's about communication and hierarchy.
When I'm recording, I notice that some of them will make these really, really long sounds and some of them are very quiet. We know that when you have maybe like 8 males together in a large tank, then like 3 of them will dominate the sound production and the other ones will be quiet. So we think there is some sort of, perhaps like some sort of hierarchy or something to do with the sounds.
So all about competition. It is not the loudest fish in the world, but why is this discovery significant?
I think it's one of those shocking things that scientists think they know everything in some respects, and then nature comes along and surprises them. As you say, it's not the biggest or the loudest fish, but it's one of the loudest for its size. In fact, it's probably the loudest for its size. And it's given scientists the sense of, wow, there's loads of new things to discover here. And it just wasn't something they were expecting.
Yeah, and this fish comes from small streams in this rural area of Myanmar. And making these discoveries in those kind of areas is very important because these kind of ecosystems could disappear, couldn't they?
Absolutely. And they think that its location is key to this massive sound that it makes, that having evolved in these murky waters, not being able to see very far, it uses this sound as a way of communicating with other members of its species. It's only made by males and only when they're in company. So they've evolved over time to produce this huge sound. And the scientists still don't know what impact it has on them or on fish that come nearby. It could be deafening them just as much as it deafens us.
Matt McGrath. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It was the middle of the night. There was a big bang on the side of the hall. And we rushed out on deck to see a very angry whale.
The perils of being stranded at sea for more than 100 days.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour. And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin. And from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood. Search for Hollywood Exiles, wherever you get your podcasts.
Life is getting much tougher in Nigeria. Prices have shot up by a third in the last year. Cynthia Adeyeri is a nurse in Abuja who's joining a two-day nationwide strike.
Things have been unbearable for the common man. The cost of living has tripled. I went to the market yesterday and I could barely buy nothing. Wasn't able to buy vegetables and fruits to make meals for my family. It's that bad.
Unions who've called the strike want the government to take action to help people make ends meet. President Bola Tinubu, who came to power last May, is going full out for economic reform, including slashing fuel subsidies. Speaking to the BBC, the finance minister, Wala Edun, admitted there were difficulties in the economy and said action was being taken.
I won't call it a crisis, but I would definitely call it a cost of living spike. There is actually food in the market. It's the purchasing power of individuals that is really at question at the moment. And that's why there's an attempt to put money into households, put money into the hands of individuals so they can purchase.
Marnie Jones is our correspondent based in Lagos.
It seems a few thousand people have shown up at this protest that's organised by the main umbrella organisation for unions in Nigeria. And they want better pay, they want an increase to kind of the minimum wage. They want the government to stick by an agreement that they've done last year to increase the pay of civil servants. And they also want the government to tackle some of the economic hardships that the people that dialed in have kind of talked about. The high cost of food, the high cost of fuel. They want the government to tackle all of these things because for the average Nigerian, life's been very hard lately.
Well, the trouble is, though, this new president has come in, say, look, we're going to shake things up. We're going to stop these high subsidies for people. And it's clearly not what a lot of people want. How does he please the people, but also continue with what he sees as the best way forward?
yeah, that's the difficult spot that he finds himself in. I think a lot of Nigerians accept that the fuel subsidy was an inefficient way of spending government money. But I think that they thought that once the government removed it, first of all, that it would remove it slower, more gradually. And secondly, that it would provide some financial help to the poorest members of society. So give them a little bit of money so they could deal with the change. Those things haven't happened. And the problem with that is because so much of the economy relies on fuel, like a lot of other countries, food has to be transported. It costs a lot more. But the thing that's different about Nigeria is that a lot of businesses also rely on fuel generators, petrol generators, to run their businesses. So if the cost of fuel goes up, the cost of power goes up for them, then it just means that everything is kind of through the roof right now. And as your listeners have kind of said dialing in, they can't afford even the basics like rice, vegetables, etc.
Marnie Jones. It is 11 days since the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny died in a prison in Siberia, kept behind bars on charges of extremism. And now one of Russia's best-known human rights campaigners, Oleg Orlov, has been jailed for discrediting the army. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
Oleg Orlov is one of Russia's most respected human rights campaigners. He'd been convicted last year of repeatedly discrediting the Russian armed forces through his public criticism of the war in Ukraine and had been given a fine. Too lenient, said prosecutors, and a retrial was ordered. That has now concluded, with Mr. Orlov being sent to prison for 2.5 years. The tougher sentence, a reflection of the intensifying crackdown on dissent in Russia.
Steve Rosenberg. To Senegal now, where elections were supposed to take place last weekend but were postponed by President Macky Sall, who offered no alternative date. The relatively stable West African country has since been thrust into chaos, with angry protesters clashing with riot police in the streets of Dakar. Almost all opposition candidates have also refused to meet Mr. Sall to agree a new election date. One of them, Anta Babacar, has been speaking to the BBC's Davina Gupta.
The president, Macky Sall's ultimate goal is to delay the presidential election as long as possible and to implement his political schemes. Now he's suggesting a time around summer for the elections. And it's a true disgrace to Senegalese democracy. It's why 17 out of the 19 candidates, like myself, validated by the Constitutional Council, did not participate in this charade. His mandate is terminating on April 2nd. If the president really wanted to leave, he just would have set a date for the elections. So there is something really dark hidden behind this, and we are worried.
You said you're among those 17 of the 19 presidential hopefuls who have not turned up for the national dialogue to set an election date and resolve this. So what's next?
What's next is very clear. Yesterday, we went to the Constitutional Council to send another request. Today is going to be declared a dead city where businesses, everything will be closed down, and it will show the state in which our country is actually really. Tomorrow, we are having a dialogue, but this dialogue is going to be with the nation, with the people, with the workers.
The dialogue with the people, does it also mean that you will be protesting again? Because you were protesting in January leaders, and you were then arrested.
We will be protesting again. We cannot not protest. And these are usually very peaceful protests. But the President Macky Sall and his administration never allow the people to actually peacefully protest. So they always send the police forces to actually attack and arrest, like I was arrested a few weeks ago. And we will keep going as long as we can, because this is the fight for our democracy and we cannot allow it to keep happening and just send the wrong signals
and
to the world.
I just want to ask you very briefly, why is it difficult for President Macky Sall to schedule a day? And what is that day or date that the opposition leaders want?
The right date should be any date before April 2nd. Any date before April 2nd, before the end of his term, so that he can actually pass power. If you don't set it before that, beforehand, it means that he's going to stay in power.
That was the opposition politician, Anta Babacar. And we end this podcast with perhaps the ultimate test of any marriage. One British couple who in the 1970s decided to leave normal life behind. They sold their house, built a small boat and set sail for New Zealand. But then something went very wrong.
It was the middle of the night. and we passed a whaling ship. There was a big bang on the side of the hull, and we rushed out on deck to see a very angry whale. It was wounded, and we assumed it had been injured by this whaling ship. And whether it took vengeance on our hull or not, I don't know, but it certainly hit us. Water was pouring in, we couldn't stop it. And the time came when we looked at each other and I said, it's time to leave. We expected to be picked up within a week. We were on the shipping route and we thought there'd be hundreds of ships going along the route. We didn't see any, of course.
Well, in fact, Morris and Marilyn were sent adrift for 117 days in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Their remarkable story of survival has now been told in a new book by Sophie Elmhurst. She's been speaking to the BBC's Nick Robinson.
They didn't have much to eat or to drink. They were kind of slowly starving as the weeks went by. But she was nothing if not resourceful. And one of her many kind of survival mechanisms and something to keep their minds occupied as much as anything else was to invent elaborate and very 1970s style dinner party menus, which she would write down laboriously in her diaries. Multi-courses, many cakes. It was just, as I say, yeah, one of many kind of ruses she had to keep them alive.
So this is an extraordinary tale of survival, of frustrated dreams. Now, sadly, neither Marilyn nor Morris are with us still. So how have you been able to tell their tale?
There are surviving friends and relatives who've been incredibly generous to me about, you know, remembering them. And they were such sort of vivid and particular characters, both in their own way, that there's been a lot of sort of rich material to draw on. And they were also sort of briefly kind of internationally famous once they were rescued. So there was lots of archive material as well.
Did they see the comedy as well as the tragedy in this shattered dream?
Well, it's a good question. I think they were both deeply pragmatic people in their own way, although one very much an optimist and one very much a pessimist, that being Morris. So I don't know if they almost saw either comedy or tragedy. I think they were more just seeing this kind of sort of endurance test.
And that's the extraordinary thing. We talk about lockdown and how tough it was. And of course, it was tough for many people. But being locked on a boat, no, with no idea when or whether you will ever be rescued, without food and water. Now, that really is a test.
Right, and it's a test of a marriage as well. And I think that's what always intrigued me from right from the start. I couldn't believe I hadn't heard of them before, that they weren't just sort of part of our collective memory, I guess, because it's such an extreme but also such an intimate story. And what does that do to a marriage? What does that do to you as an individual? But what does that do to your relationship?
Yeah, presumably, while you're on life raft, your choices are limited.
Yeah.
You've got to go off with someone else.
That's true.
You know, go for a walk.
That's true. Yeah. But I guess it's a testament to their... And maybe, you know, we would all be, let's hope we'd all be as resourceful as they were, but a testament to their kind of devotion to each other as much as anything that they survived.
And that's all from us for now. But there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by James Piper and the producer was Alfie Habersham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.